And then I said to myself, I like to talk to myself because I pay attention. Now, if it's Spence, that's foolishness. They'll think that is ridiculous. I'm still tempted to do it, though. But anyway, as I look towards the rear of this large building, I see that the deacons have been very active. I don't know, maybe they suspected I was going to do something like this or comment. I don't know, doing a good job. But it is something that we all must learn to do. And it's something that is not natural with us, and that is this matter of enduring, or perseverance, if you might want to call it by that title. There's just something about our human nature that we want action now. We want a decision made now. If we have a problem, we want it taken care of now. And it seems like when we come into the church of God and the Spirit of God starts working in our mind and we start understanding the way things should be and we see that they are not that way, we want changes made now. And we find it very difficult to understand why the changes haven't been. Oh, we can look at the political scene. We can look at the foreign scene. We can look at any kind of a scene you want outside the church, and we understand and say, well, I understand that because, after all, doesn't the Bible say that Satan deceives the whole world? And it does say that. So therefore, we can have a little bit of patience. But now, our brothers and sisters in the church, they should know better. The church should know better. Why don't they make this change? Why don't they make that change? Why do they allow this? Why do they allow that? Why do they do this? Why do they don't do that? And so on. And we become very impatient. And we don't want to endure maybe some of the trials, the problems, the situations, the frustrations as we live our lives as a son and daughter of Almighty God. And in a way, it's like a mother and a father. They'll see their youngster. Oh, when they're small, you know, and they're little infants, or maybe they're in that cute age stage or what. You know, they're so cute and so wonderful, and they're our children and this, that, and they allow for their mistakes. But when they start entering into the teens or thereabouts, we start expecting more from them, which we should. But so often we expect more than we really should. Daughter, why can't she kick like mother? And why can't that young man keep the lawn, clean out the garage, or do the work like his father? We find it very difficult to understand why they can't grasp it. If we tell them once, I mean, after all, if they're paying attention, right? If you're paying attention, you ought to learn it one time. That's all you need. And yet the Bible is filled with injunction, with instruction, with correction, with guidance, time after time after time after time, because God knows we're pretty thick-headed. Well, we hear the word. We hear the instruction. We hear the guidance. But then we start modifying it. And we start watering it down because I'm special. In my case, this is allowable. Well, I'm just weak. Well, I'll overcome that next week. Well, I'll change this later on when I'm stronger. And really, I think of all of us, if we apply the same stringent rules that we tend to do with our youngsters, we would fall flat on our face quickly And be thankful that God is merciful and kind and He is enduring you. You know, God must look down sometimes and shake His head and turn to Christ and say, boy, we got a doozy in this one. But He's very patient and very kind and very loving. But brethren, our big problems so often relate not to our fellow workers, wherever your job might be, not to society, not even necessarily with our friends who are outside the church, but most of the time the problems relate to that overall empirical self that involves the Spirit of God. That means you as a child of God. It involves your brothers and sisters in the church, and the church at large. And so anything that takes place on that very close plane, it seems when we're going out, when we are looking out, we have a much stricter, much, much stricter bunch of rules and regulations and requirements. And when they don't live up to that, boy, thumbs down. But now when it comes the other way, now that's another matter. We excuse and we justify. And we let ourselves do many things that someone else didn't say that's not right. You know, the biggest thing that we have to endure, brethren, is self. Your nature, my nature. I think all of us who have been in the church any length of time whatsoever realize that when we first came into the church, we first came to a knowledge of what God said to do. We found out about the Sabbath day. In most cases, that was a little bit difficult because most of us were used to observing Sunday as the day of worship, the holy day. Like one of the fellows told me in St. Louis Church, he said, well, I see you're going to be a Sunday preacher. So I'm preaching on Sunday. We came out of various denominations, various churches. And we realize that according to the Word of God, He says, you shall keep the seventh day holy. And that was difficult. In some cases, in a number of cases involved, actually, even a change of jobs. Because obviously you cannot keep a day holy and also be working on that day. Well, that's a little bit difficult to get over. And I can well remember when I first started attending, it was in Pasadena at that time, we lived in San Fernando Valley. And it seems like God hit me right between the eyes every Sabbath. Well, it was only true. I mean, after all, He was opening my mind to the new truth. So I found out about the Sabbath, started keeping the Sabbath. Didn't want to do it, but I couldn't find any loopholes. And the next Sabbath, they were teaching tithing. Now, I thought that I was a pretty good Christian. My sons then at that time were very small infants. So I figured, well, it's about time they had started having a little bit of Christian teaching. So I started attending the nearest church to where we lived at that time. And of course, I thought, well, I should be helping them out. So I gave them $5 every Sunday. They made me a deacon in a month. I think, well, that's a pretty good amount, $5. I mean, you know, it wasn't bad. At that time, I think I was making around $200, $200 and a quarter a week, which is an excellent salary in those years. And I'm sitting there comfortably, well satisfied with myself, young, growing Christian. And this fellow gets up there and says, "Hey, man." Not in those words, of course. He says, "God says you should be commanding. You are commanded, rather, to tithe." I said, "That's right, man. I've been given $5 a Sunday. I agree with that. Tithing is right." Then he explained about a tenth. I never heard that before in my life. And I said to myself, this guy is out of his ever-loving mind. I mean, Uncle Sam has both hands in my pockets. And now he's saying I'm supposed to tithe. I went home. I started reviewing the sermon notes, the scriptures. Again, I searched for that loophole. Couldn't find it. Ew, that hurt, man. He was getting me now where it was really something. You see, the Sabbath hadn't really been too big a problem in my life because the type of job I had, I worked for the Bendix at that time as a purchasing agent, we didn't work Saturday anyway. So that was no big deal, just switch from Saturday, I mean from Sunday to Saturday. But now tithing, he was getting real, real personal. Well, I started enduring that, you know. Got paid that week. I wrote it out. And I found out, brethren, that since that time, I've never wanted. Oh, I'll take that back. I've wanted a lot of things. But I've not wanted for what I needed. Well, this was long about August 1955. Came to church next Sabbath. And this young man up there is speaking about the wonderful, wonderful Feast of Tabernacles. And I heard the word feast and said, "Boy, that sounds like food. That's good. I like that." He's really getting to myself now. So, I said, "Boy, that's real good." Then along about halfway through the sermon, he says, "And when we go to Big Sandy," he says, "Big Sandy what?" Later on, he says, "Texas, outside of Gladewater, Texas." I'd never been in Texas in all my life, had no desire to go to Texas. All I ever heard about Texas was cowboys and oil wells and cactus. You know, I didn't want to go to Texas. Didn't ask me whether I wanted to go. He was up there speaking real dogmatically, like saying, "God says you shall go." I don't want to go. Besides, I couldn't afford it. Next Sabbath, he told me how I was going to afford it. Brethren, you talk about enduring. I was in a state of shock, I think, for 2 months straight. I enjoyed the sermons. I thought they were very inspirational. They were wonderful, but I didn't like what I heard. It didn't agree with myself, with the inner man, with me. I mean, I was pretty happy doing my own thing, giving my wife a rough time, being the head of the house. If I wanted to go fishing, I went fishing. Now all of a sudden I found out I better start learning how to wisely spend my money because somebody else had a prior claim to it. Well, that year I reasoned around why I could not. And actually, I couldn't that first year because it was only about 3 or 4 weeks before the feast started, and I just didn't have it. And I wasn't going to spend my savings. I mean, that was being ridiculous. At least so I thought. But I knew I had to keep the holy days, so the days came. Feast of Trumpets, that was beautiful. I really enjoyed that. And we did have a feast, spiritual and physical. But now the next one came along, the Day of Atonement. I said to myself, Spence, again, I like to talk to myself. I said, this church is really out of line. I mean, I can understand maybe skipping a noon meal or breakfast, maybe. But not even taking a drink of beer or water or something, I'll die. But I didn't. And then everybody left. It's wet. Gone. Most left right after the Day of Atonement because in California, most were driving back to Big Sandy in those days, those years. We didn't have any closer feast sites, so usually they took about 3 days driving there. And so I observed the Holy Day all by myself. I took a blanket, I went up to the San Fernando Park, took my Bible, and decided, well, I'll go up there and commune with nature. I never got so tired looking at sawgrass, blades of grass in all my life. And that was one of the longest days of the year. I couldn't believe it. I said, well, I'll study a while. And I started reading the Bible, and I read, and I read, and read. And after about 5 minutes of that, I got tired. And I spent the rest of the day watching that slow-moving sun. Waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting. It says, this sun must have breaks on it somewhere. Well, maybe this is just some of the things that I've gone through. I don't know. There was a lot of physical enduring when I came into the church. And it was difficult as we went through the initial times, getting used to the Sabbath, the holy days, tithing. But I've found since that really, although that was a trial, and although that was and did involve a lot of enduring, it was as nothing compared to the enduring that subsequently I've had to go through and you have had to go through when we have found out some of our loved ones. The mental enduring, as we have experienced some of the things that have happened in the Church of God. And sometimes enduring individuals and positions of responsibility that cause problems for us individually. And you want to say, how long, O God, can this happen? Why do you let this individual remain a position influence? Or maybe someone who's a very close friend. And it seems like they just become progressively more and more and more bitter, upset, finger-pointing, negative. And you have to endure it because there's really, well, you really don't know what you can do because you are praying already. You just kind of wish you had a magic hammer you could hit them on the head with and make them up. But then the greatest enduring of all, like I said, is number one, right down here, inside. And so often we don't even realize ourselves how treacherous, how reasoning and excusing and justifying we are as we excuse ourselves from just slightly, you know, just slightly maybe disobeying God. And God knows, and really deep down deep, we know when we are living in disobedience to God. And we almost want God to be our servant. Say, God, take care of this fellow. God, take care of that woman. God, take care of this situation. And we pray about it almost in the commanding tone. And then we come to say, or we think, and some have thought this, how can this be the church of God if God allows that to happen? Rather than looking to the fruit of the Spirit of God. I hope, brethren, you can say, as I say now, and I mean it, I am not, and I'll stress that, I am not the same man I was when I came into the church. And the reason I am not is because of the power of God's Spirit and the changes that God has worked in my life. I'd like to use the example, and I've used it more than once, so some of you have heard it, endure me. And that is the example of the power of God, likening it to the generators at any large dam, hydroelectric power or coal-fired power, whatever it might be. Tremendous generation coming forth from some source to run motors, to turn on electrical lights, all types of things that they do with electricity. But in order to use that power, there has to be a switch or a rheostat turned. And in our case, in the spiritual sense, to use the great power of Almighty God, and that power is there available, but it will not come upon us unless we flip our switch. That means we have to desire it, we want it, and we ask for it. And if we really want it, God gives it to us. Of course, we have to watch. We want to say, God, give me 10 megawatts. And God says, no, I'll give you 1 milliwatt. He gives us what we need, using whatever ability we do have. The Bible speaks in many places about overcoming. Our worst enemy is self. And sometimes we have to endure ourselves in frustration, in anguish, in tears, and crying out. Because God knows we have to overcome that self, and you just cannot automatically, overnight, immediately become perfect. Sometimes we have to go through various trials. It's like when we're in school. First, you have to learn the tables. 2 times 2 is 4. 3 times 3 is 9. 4 times 4 is 16. 5 times 5 is 20. Well, that's a different table, isn't it? But sometimes, you see, we follow up the tables like that. We put our own reasoning and twist upon our lives. But after we learn the tables, using the same mathematical example, we could go on to algebra and trigonometry, calculus. There's no way that you could learn and use calculus if you didn't know the tables. Well, in like manner, brethren, we have to start, and we all start on the ground floor. And our rate of growth, our rate of overcoming, our rate of change depends upon us and how often we flip the switch. There is no such thing as longevity in the church of God. Seniority. Just because I have been in the church, for example, 25 years in round figures, doesn't mean that I automatically have an accumulation of 25 years of God's Spirit. And could never fall away. Some are really dedicated and zealous and hating and rebelling against the self, tired of enduring that self, and therefore they go to God more often and they turn the switch more often, and therefore they grow more than some individuals have grown. Perhaps in 1 year they grow more than some in 10 or 15 or 20. I don't know. And who am I or who are you to look at someone else and say, hey, I'm better than that individual. because, boy, I'm doing this and I'm doing that. I'm helping the widows. I'm giving here. I'm going there. I'm really serving. When perhaps percentage-wise, and God looks on the percent, that individual has grown maybe double or triple or quadruple what you've grown because you had a lot more to begin with than they did. And thinking about this matter of serving, brethren, the Feast of Tabernacles is much more than just a feast of receiving in, whether it be of food, spiritual or physical, but it is also an opportunity to serve in various ways. And we have had a dismal lack of volunteers, which makes you wonder, perhaps too many are just here to enjoy it. In a physical sense, where's the spiritual approach? Talking with the deaconess, she said 14 volunteers to help her serve. In the ladies' room, 3 showed up. Now, that's what we're like. That's what I'm like. I don't think you're any different. I like to take it easy. I like to enjoy life. I still thank Dr. Hay. And I don't remember what year this was. Obviously in the earlier years when I came in the church. Night to be observed, I was in line. And of course, in those years, we still had the old tennis court building, tennis court beside the building that's now the library and Vassar College. And all the ladies, of course, they brought in their goodies. And that's one thing about the church. Everyone, unless they're in a bad attitude, brings their best dish. And things are always so tasty and so good on any of the holy days and the night to be observed, of course. So I'm standing in line licking my chops. Boy, I really wanted to get down there and have some of that food. I could see it laid out there, all those cakes and pies and salads. And I was hungry. So I got about to the point, just about, really, about 3 people from when I was going to go shooting out to that line, you know. Only about 1 or 2 had gone already, and Dr. Hay was standing there. And he said, "Say, Mr. Spence, why don't you stand over here and direct traffic?" Well, tremendous, beneficent, wonderful thoughts came into my mind. And don't you believe it? That is ridiculous. And grumble. And here I'm hungry. He wants me to stand over and direct traffic. I mean, all the food, all the goodies are going to be gone by the time I get there. So I did. And that started me off. Every holiday thereafter, you know, that I was directing traffic or doing something. Had a ball, had a wonderful time. Got to know most of the people. So I started sharing in then in some of the spiritual blessings. And I never really lacked for the food. Time went by. And I was ordained a deacon. Had a little trouble with that one. I still remember the night we were ordained, Tom Justice and myself. We went home and we discussed the problems of the world. And now we had this very responsible position. I mean, we were the deacons. Not too long thereafter, Mr. Armstrong gave a sermon about some of these deacons who thought they were running the church. Well, I think there were 3 deacons that time who'd been deacons a long time, and they obviously weren't trying to run the church. which only left about three others of us who were newly ordained, it was kind of difficult to reason around why it didn't apply to me. So my head got punctured in a hurry. Then a little time went by. Later on, I went to Ambassador College, and they ordained me as a local elder. I'll never forget that day, because, again, all the food had been laid out. At this time, they had a much larger tennis court, a lot more food. And I'd gotten used as a deacon. We'd go over there, we'd leave services, you know, before the end of the sermon. And the deaconesses and the ladies were helping and lay it out. And I'd be out there drafting traffic, you know, and set the stuff here. And then every now and then, I'd grab a chicken leg or something. I wasn't missing any food at all, man. I was having the choice. Then they ordained me a local elder. And I'd go stand in a stupid line along with the rest of us. I'd stand in line instead of going out there, you know, with the deacon in charge. Grab this, grab that, you know. And I still remember standing on that tennis court and the track, you know, going all three-quarters of the way around that track before we got to the food. And I'm saying to myself, why me, God? Why couldn't I just stay the deacon? I was happy. I enjoyed the position. I enjoyed serving. Now here I am, standing in line. Little realizing, brethren, that really it's up to the individual, but the more opportunities we have of serving, the greater the blessing. To me, it's a tremendous blessing just to be able to speak to the people of God. Now, I've learned a few lessons. I've learned, number one, you better not put yourself first. You better go to God and claim His promise of inspiration, of help, of guidance. Otherwise, you're going to be standing up there, and this has happened a couple times to me, where no thoughts come to mind, no examples come to mind. You lose your place in the Bible. And you talk about a humbling situation. But what a blessing it is for the spinoff of any individual in serving. And yet ourself, our human nature, doesn't want to do it. Ourself wants to take care of self and endure the rest, waiting for the next opportunity to satiate or satisfy our selfish desires. In Matthew, the 10th chapter, in verse 22, he says, "You shall be hated of all for my name's sake. But he that endures to the end shall be saved." I don't know what there is about it, but there is an automatic antagonism, it seems, that develops when one has the Spirit of God and someone else does not. I think we've all experienced that. Perhaps we've wanted to encourage, to teach, to guide, even try to convert a loved one. And it just seems like there is a rebellion or a spirit of antagonism. Of course, doesn't God say, except two agree, how can they walk together? And the Spirit of God has to be there working with both minds. And so it is here. The Spirit of God is being poured out upon the church in ever increasing amounts, but again, we are the switches. Individually, separately, we are deciding how much of that Spirit we are going to use in our own life of overcoming this self that we endure every day. I'm sure that most at times have wished, I wish I had more love, more compassion, more thoughtfulness, more consideration, more of the very fruits of Almighty God. we turn right around and do something, you put the switch off. And we come to the place, or should come to the place, where we abhor ourselves. Brethren, we've got to stop pointing the finger unless we point it at ourselves. Talking with a fellow the other day, I was bringing out, you know, years ago I decided, when I was in the Marine Corps, it seems like I automatically was assigned to a unit that had some of the least qualified officers. Automatically. I'll never forget Sergeant Scott in boot camp. The Sergeant Scott and the other sergeants had a way of making believers out of us. And the officers had a way of making believers out of us, because in those days you either obeyed and did what they said, or there was such a thing called the brig or the jail. I spent some time in jail. Came back from overseas and they put me in light duty. I was working behind the soda fountain, making sodas and sundaes and all those other good things. I always assumed when somebody left any money on the top of the counter that that was a tip. Not in the Marine Corps, that's Uncle Sam. But anyway, the major and the lieutenant who were in charge of the PX embezzled around $50,000. So military intelligence came in one Sunday morning. I can still remember, I was sitting there reading the funnies. You know, I was always up on the news. And listening to "The Eyes of Texas Are Upon You" on the jukebox. These two big guys come up, and I mean, they were big guys. And they asked me if I was Robert Spence. I said, yes. Just come with us. Just come where? And they had some appropriate words to tell me, it's none of my business, just come. They picked up every individual who worked in the PX. Took us down, interrogated us, scared. Man, I was scared. I still remember my knees knocking to "The Eyes of Texas Upon You." They were just vibrating away there. And now, what have I done? What'd they do? You know, they're accusing me of stealing $50,000. I mean, I'm the soda jerk. So they locked us all up, solitary confinement. And I didn't like that at all, especially when we went to chow. And there must have been around, I would say, a little over 100, maybe 125 or 30 of us in the stockade at that time. And they marched us over to chow hall. It was about a quarter of a mile away. And all around us were our former buddies, now carrying shotguns. And it's amazing how large the end of a shotgun is when it's pointed towards you. So we chop over to the chow and have chow hall and had something to eat, came back, and that went on about 10 days. I didn't like the brig. I didn't like the way they treated me. And of course, I didn't have any hair anymore. That's the first thing they do, you know, is to humble you, to take your hair off. And then they released it. I don't know where they ever did catch that major and lieutenant. I sure hope they did. He's the one who got me into that mess. But I still remember, I signed a confession. I stole from Uncle Sam, I believe it was $15.87. Those weren't tips, buddy. You stole from Uncle Sam. You should have put that in the cash register. Well, I endured that because I had to. I wanted to leave. It's just like when I first went in the Marines. First thing I did was I sat in that bunk and I looked out at the setting sun and the tears streamed down my cheeks. I wanted to get out of here. I didn't like the way they treated me. I didn't like what they called me. And I had to endure it. The end of the war came. Going home, I was in Guam. So they put us on board a ship and we went to China. And had to endure that. Various actions during the war, of course, as we had individuals that were not qualified. And brethren, let's face it, most of the time when we think of somebody being qualified for any position whatsoever, it's number one. I can do a better job than him. What's he doing in that job? Or you can look at a brother or sister and say, boy, what a lousy job of child rearing they're doing. Or you can look at him and say, boy, he sure doesn't love his wife. Look at the way he's treating her. Or look at her, man, she is really something else again. I'm sure glad I'm not married to her. Well, that's true. I'm glad I'm not married to some of you. And you should be glad you're not married to me. It's like some people say, boy, I wish I was in their shoes. You know, and usually that's somebody who is better looking. So that applies to most of us. Or has more money. Or has something that we would like to have, right? What we don't know is maybe that individual we'd like to exchange shoes with, maybe they're almost dead of cancer. You know, it's like God said, he says, what's it going to gain you if you get the whole world but lose your soul? A getting, acquiring society. Got to have more homes, larger homes, bigger homes, more cars, more swimming pools, airplanes, boats, whatever you want, as if that is happiness. And brethren, we've got to realize that we have got to endure all our lives. Revelation, the second chapter, and verse 26. And he that overcomes and keeps my works unto the end. How long are you going to live? How long will I live? None of us know. So why should we say, well, I'm going to overcome this tomorrow or next week when I get a little bit stronger, I'll change that. Putting off to the next day, something you should do today. I'm kind of paraphrasing it. How do you know how long you are going to live? And some, you know, I think we all know individuals who are suffering from various afflictions. I remember I know of several who have various types of physical afflictions. Some of them a type of affliction that you wonder why they have not already died. Now they've been anointed, prayed for, several times. And human nature says, well, why hasn't God intervened, raised them up? And they seem to keep living and living and living rather than perhaps, if God has let this happen to some, let them die, they've made it. They're going to come up in the resurrection. But some, it seems, they keep enduring and enduring and enduring, and you almost wonder, why does God allow them to keep suffering? And you know, the next thought that automatically will come to our mind, God's not fair. Because we can look right over and see someone else in the full bloom of health, maybe having a beautiful marriage, obedient children, wonderful home. And as far as you can tell, no problems. How can God be fair if he lets one sister or brother be in this condition? And over here, here's an individual having this condition. And the self wants to find fault with God. And brethren, we need to realize that self, that inner nature, that being that we are naturally,
coupled with being influenced and amplified by the spirit of Satan, wants to find escape holes from obeying God. Now you know, or you should know, salvation is between you and God alone. We are influenced by other people. The one who has the greatest influence upon me is my wife. She can influence me if she's not feeling well. It influences me. If she's acting like a female, then she influences me there too. And sometimes I think my character's developed by being married. Which, of course, it's probably a lot worse the other way. She likes to tell the story, and it's sort of true. We are different. When I'm not feeling well, I just want to be left alone. If I'm miserable, just leave me alone. Let me die in peace, you know. Don't come around and put a cloth on my forehead, you know, and do all those nice things. I don't want to, just leave me alone. I don't want to be bothered. I'm just so terrible. I want to feel sorry for myself and die. Or if she would like to have a little attention, a cloth on her forehead or something like that. Several years ago, she sprained both ankles. So she was, you know, healthy other than she couldn't walk very well. So I came home from somewhere, and the boys were home, and so we were cooking something to eat, you know, and you know, shooting the breeze like men will, and having a ball. And she could hear us talking, but nobody thought to take any food up to her. Didn't enter my mind. I thought, well, if she's hungry, she'll yell or come down or something, you know. So I, in many ways, am quite an endurance to my wife. Or I should say, cause her to endure me. But we've got to overcome. That means enduring, persevering, on to the very end. When's the end? Like I said, I don't know when I'm going to die. I don't plan on dying. If it's left up to me, I'm going to stay alive until Christ returns. But he hasn't yet given me that right. Neither has he given it to you. You know, I use a lot of my own personal examples, not to puff me up, but because I realize I'm just a normal human being, which means others have gone through similar types of experiences. Not one of us is a special individual in God's sight. We're all his children. And just like we have two boys, we love them both, but they're separate individuals. They have different types of personalities, but it doesn't mean we don't love them. We do. We might handle them or work with them a little bit differently because they are different. And so it is with God with us. And when we start feeling sorry for ourselves and excusing ourselves and reasoning with ourselves, sometimes God deals with us differently than with others. And sometimes perhaps God allows, as I mentioned before, the individuals who continue to have perhaps this physical affliction and God hasn't yet intervened. Those individuals sometimes need to realize that maybe it's not just for them, although certainly they will grow in character as they endure that physical trial. But sometimes God allows that to happen as an opportunity for others in that family to grow in character and reliance upon God. If God answered our prayers immediately and right away, there wouldn't be any reason to have patience and perseverance and enduring. But God doesn't do that. And yet God will intervene. He will never forsake us. He will never leave us. But just as a wise parent loves their child, And sometimes we'll allow them to do things, like a mother will allow her daughter to make a flop of making that cake so that the daughter can learn, you know, that there is a reason for a certain amount of baking soda, baking powder, whatever it might be you want to put in there. And quite often, as young people, we learn by doing. It is an exceptional individual, young person, who listens to his folk and never questions what the folk say. But most of us, and I include myself, when our parents were telling us something, we say, yes, we agreed with them, but mentally we said, however, you don't understand. Things are different now. Now, that's what I thought when I was a young man. My mother used to interrogate me, where are you going? I didn't really know where I was going. I just going to be with the fellas and have fun, you know, quote unquote, and whatever unfolded during the night, you know. We went down to Dunn's Parlor. And some of us had maybe a nickel, and we could stick it in the Nickelodeon. That was an ancient history, kids. I realized that. You know. And we'd play a song, and there was a little dance floor there, and if there were some girls there, we'd dance with them. And we didn't know what we were going to do. Didn't have any guidance, any direction. Whatever came. And that's the way the world is. No guidance, no direction, just confusion. But brethren, in the church of God, God is guiding and he is directing and he is thundering out the way of life that results in eternity. The way of life that is going to do away with the frustrations, the misery, and the unhappiness of this physical life. But how often, how very, 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 very often do we look at ourselves, our physical self, and we forget what it might be like in the years ahead. We become so occupied with working so we can pay the mortgage or pay the rent or put some food on the table or whatever it might be in this world that we forget what is the real purpose of life. Why are we here? Why am I growing old? I'm beginning to say that to myself more and more. And when somebody guesses my age and it guesses about 10 years younger than what it actually is, boy, do I feel good. Really makes me feel good. But real deep down in my heart, I know how old I am. And I know that I don't function as ably, as quickly, as energetically as I did when I was younger. And how many of us express the thought, oh, if I just had the body with what I know now. And you think back, oh, man. If I was just, what age do you want, 18, 19, 20, 21 again? Of course, some of you are waiting to be that age, I realize. But most of us, if we could just go back and be, say, 21 again, and have what we know upstairs, and have the lessons and profit from some of the things we've gone through. I mean, there's so many hard lessons. Thought comes to mind, I remember one time we went up to visit a girl, lived in a town about 18 miles from where I lived in Fremont, Nebraska, and I was riding a little motor scooter. Never ridden it before in my life. Borrowed it, so I'm roaring up there 18 miles, doing fine. No strain. Till I came up to where the railroad track crossed the highway. And there was a freight train coming. And I realized, I better stop. Because that train was a lot bigger than me riding on this little motor scooter.
Well, this type of motor scooter, the way you stopped it was you pressed this little metal bar down on top of the spark plug, which shorted out the magneto spark coming. That's the way you stopped the motor. No flipping switch or anything else, you just pressed it down. So here I am roaring up at about 40 miles an hour towards this railroad track. The train, he's roaring down the track about 40 miles an hour. And we have a point of destiny, which I didn't want to be there. So I'm, you know, steering in my left hand. I'm trying to find where is that stupid thing at? You know, I'm pressing down various things, burnt my finger, I hit the top of the cylinder here. All of a sudden, I did stop that motor scooter because I put my finger between the belt and the pulley. And we stopped. And I voiced my appreciation. I just threw that in for those of you who have been sleeping back there. I can still remember that night, because every time my heart beat, that finger went whoom, whoom. I learned that lesson. You don't stop motor scooters by sticking your finger in between the belt and that little wheel. So wouldn't it be nice if we could come back and have a young body, a young mind, but still know what we know now? Have you ever wanted to do that? Well, we can. And we're going to be, for those who are obedient, in a much better condition, no longer having just the physical body. But then at the resurrection, we'll have a spiritual body. And finally, with what we have learned, we will have the full power of God. And not only that, but we'll have the power to make a judgmental decision and carry it out at that time. I think all of us at times have seen something that needed to be done. I'm sure there has been at least one individual driving out of this parking lot who refused to obey the man out there who was maybe trying to stop him so that the other line could go through. I'm going forward, you know. I'm sure there's been at least one. I'm sure also that parking attendant at that time wished he had the power of God and he could just say, you know, and just push the car back. Maybe even bend the fender up a little bit to teach him a lesson. But brethren, we need to realize that in the days that this feast pictures, the people are going to be physical human beings. And they're going to have to be taught the right way. The Spirit of God, of course, is going to make it possible because their minds will be open. But in that last great day, which pictures the great resurrection of all who've never had a chance, and I was thinking this morning, you know, unless God calls someone in a few short years ahead, I probably am the only one in my family. My dad has died. My sisters aren't interested. And I kind of look forward to talking with them. Say, hey, you thought I was a weirdo, didn't you? You thought this was really weird, keeping the Sabbath and the holy days and going off the Ozarks for 8-9 days, you know. You thought that was really weird, and tithing, you thought I was out of my ever-loving mind. Now let me instruct you a little bit. I remember my friend, Bob Bitney, that I went to school with and used to go out on dates with. Bob's dead now. But I stopped by to see him when I was transferred to New York City area. And we were reviewing old times, and I'm dying of thirst. Well, it wasn't really, but I thought it was, you know. It was a hot summer day.
And finally I said, "Hey, Bob, why don't you offer me a beer?" And he said, "Oh, I didn't know you drank." And it's going to be an opportunity, you see, at that time to educate the people of the right way of Christianity. Not a false way, a way of a bunch of do's and don'ts. If you're a Christian, you do this and you don't do that, and you do this and you don't do that. But a Christian way of living from the self, the innermost being, empowered by the Spirit of God, overcoming the one that is the hardest to overcome, yourself. And stop the finger pointing, and stop the excusing, and stop making judgmental decisions, because if you can't carry it out, then you carry it to God. It's like those fellows in the service. They made decisions, and I learned the hard way. Well, what good's it going to do me? If I can't make a decision, if I can't be empowered to make a change, why should I get all frustrated? Now, maybe you might not like the way things have been conducted. Maybe it would not be conducted the same way as it would if you were in charge, and I'm sure that's true, because we're all different. But the fact still remains, God's running the show. And it's up to Him that we should go. I value my life. I really do. I really want to be there. I want to finally have some intelligence that is real intelligence. And with it, and the experiences I've had, learning many lessons the hard way, I want to have the power of God so that I can carry out and do and serve in a good and a right way. And we have been given that opportunity. You have been given that opportunity, and I have been given that opportunity. And yet God says, "Why do you call me Lord, Lord, and not do what I say?" And the self says, "Yeah, but I want to keep the Sabbath the way I think is right. I want to keep the holy days the way I think is right. I want to tithe the way I think is right. This is my interpretation of the Bible." And brethren, we need to realize God looks down on our heart. He really does. He checks us out. And if you want to find escape clauses, you'll find them, because you'll make them. But if you really, I mean really want to be there, you really want to be changed, you really want to finally have the love of God and the power of God, and your whole being wants that above everything else, and that's your attitude, no matter what might transpire, no matter what might happen, you keep that attitude and you will receive the gift of eternal life. In 1 Corinthians, the 9th chapter, in verse 24, says, "Know you not that they which run in a race run all, but one receives the prize? And so run that you may obtain. Every man that strives for the mastery is temperate in all things. Now they do it to obtain a corruptible crown, but we an incorruptible. And so therefore, so run I, not as uncertainly, so fight I, not as one that beats the air." In other words, Paul's saying here, he says, "Look, I didn't play act, I'm running. I didn't sort of jog in one place and I'm really spinning my arms around, I'm breathing heavy as, boy, I'm really running a race, but I'm hardly moving." No. He recognized. He had to strive. He says, "I keep my body, I keep under my body and bring it under subjection." lest by any means when I preach to others, I myself should be a castaway. Now, if an apostle could say that, how much more could we say that? I don't want to be a castaway. But I want to strive and I want to overcome. Oh yes, I admit, I have failures. I backslide. But this I know, is God is compassionate and merciful. And if I really get on my knees and ask God to forgive me, He does. And He forgets it. Why should I keep moaning and groaning and complaining and bringing it up before Him all the time? If I've really repented, I repented. God knows it and He forgets it. Never make the mistake that every time you pray, you keep going back and recount and recount and recount your sins. God knows that, and He's forgotten them. But I want to be there, and I want to keep my body under suggestion. That means myself. That means me. That means you and yourself. And so we live this life and we endure this life. We endure the human nature that we still have. Gradually we should be changing it as we flip that switch and have more and more of the power of God. But I think we all realize there are events that lie ahead of the church. The great tribulation, we say, well, I won't be there. I'm going to be obedient to God. I'll be in the place of safety, wherever that might be. Sometimes people speculate on where this place of safety is. Some say Petra. Well, how are you going to get to Petra? That's across the ocean. I don't know. I don't know where this course is going to be. It's like I told the St. Louis Church, maybe it's East St. Louis. I don't know. I don't care where it is. I just want to be there. But do you realize, brethren, you talk about a time of trial? And sometimes people say, boy, once God protects us and we're removed and we're over there wherever it might be, we're never or ever more going to have the problems. Oh yes, because you are the problem. And if some have a problem now getting along with their brother or sister who lives across town, what are you going to do if they're living right next to you? In very close proximity. And maybe they have been deficient in rearing their children. Or whatever. So whatever the trials might be, I don't know. We're going to have trials. We're going to have troubles. As I said before, I think most will be right here amongst ourselves because we're so close to each other. If a brother or a sister gets angry at me, and gives me hurtful words or whatever it might be, or takes advantage of me, that would hurt me a lot more than someone whom I just might know in a business way. Because that's my brother, that's my sister. How can they do that to me? Well, they do it to you because they haven't been as close to God as they should have been. And maybe God is allowing it for you to endure and grow in character and patience, and recognize we're all a bunch of clods. I mean, who's the great and the mighty amongst us? We don't have too many great and mighty among us. We just don't. And yet, look what God is working with us. He's changing us. He's empowering us and giving us the power of His Spirit and the love of God. And with the wonderful promise of being able to really serve in the world tomorrow as God. So I think that's something we need to realize. And God says, I will never forsake you. Sometimes we think God has when He allows the trials to happen. But we shouldn't do that because He's there. He knows what's going on and He knows it's for our good. Hebrews 13 and verse 5. Where He says, let your conduct be without covetousness and be content with such things as you have, for He has said, I will never leave you nor forsake you. That's a promise. And we can go to God and receive help. And then in the 12th chapter of Hebrews, verse 1, Hebrews 12, verse 1, "Wherefore, seeing we are also are compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which does so easily beset us, and let us run with patience the race that is set before us." My race is my life. Your race is your life. The cross you bear is what you are. That includes everything about you, your physical circumstances, financial. Might even be the one you're married for, all I know. Whatever your cross might be, that's your life. Maybe God called you and you didn't have much education, and therefore you really cannot and are not capable of earning even an average living. But God has called you and blessed his with his Spirit. For you to find fault with God is foolishness. For in his sight you are richer by far than any millionaire. Verse 2, and this is the key. This is the way you flip that switch. This is the way you receive the power of God. This is the way you receive the ability to overcome. This is the way you receive the love of God, that Christ living his life in you can mold you and shape you and form you. And this is the way you can receive eternity by God's gift when Christ returns. It says, looking unto Jesus, the author and should read, and perfecter. And if we flip our own personal switches and we really look to Christ to live his life in us, to mold us, shape us, form us, change us, yes, and correct us, then we will receive the gift of eternity, of life eternal, of immortality. And I want to hear the words, as I hope and pray you want to hear those words said by God. Well done, good and faithful servant. Enter ye into life.